When we began our series earlier this summer on the Great American Songbook, we introduced it by saying it's not really a book. And yet, the contents of that songbook formed the basis of American popular song for much of the 20th century. Here to help clarify and navigate us through the imaginary pages of real-life music is director Adam Copeland of Flying Carpet Theater. Adam, welcome back to City Lights.
It is great to be here, as always.
Wonderful to have you. When Barbara Cook died on August 8th at the age of 89, the New York Times lauded her as one of the finest emotive interpreters of the Great American Songbook. Right there in the newspaper, presuming everyone who was reading the obituary knew the meaning of the Great American Songbook. Please tell us about this invisible volume of music.
Well, another word for the Great American Songbook is also American standards. You hear both. And often there is a fuzziness about what that means. It's a canon, a list of songs that get done and reinterpreted by artists again and again, and they form, as you said, kind of the backbone of American popular music of the 20th century. They flourished for about a 50-year window, maybe a little bit more, from about 1920, the teens in the 20s, through the 50s. And it represented a time when there was an explosion in the craft of songwriting and kind of an attention to how songs should be marketed, how they should be crafted, how they should be distributed. And like all lists or canons, it's fluid. Things get rediscovered, things get left behind. There are about maybe 20 or 30 names that you see again and again when talking about the Great American Songbook. Most scholars of it say that it begins with really six composers: Harold Arlen, Richard Rodgers, Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, and George Gershwin. Lyricists like P.G. Wodehouse, Irving Berlin himself, Lawrence Hart, Oscar Hammerstein II, Yip Harburg, Dorothy Field, Ira Gershwin, Johnny Mercer, and Cole Porter, also important figures. And the list of interpreters goes on and on. And I think we'll begin there.
Okay, well, on the topic of imaginary things with real life lasting impact, what is Tin Pan Alley and where is it located?
Tin Pan Alley has had actually a few homes over its life. Tin Pan Alley is the epicenter of the music publishing world in New York. And we should probably talk a little bit about how music was experienced at the turn of the century. We now stream our music, we listen to it on our phones, etc. At the time, the way people heard music, obviously, was live performance or often in their homes. It was very common, even for poor folks, to have a piano in their homes at the turn of the century because people like music and you needed to hear it somehow. And so often people would hear a popular song in a club or on the stage, and then they would buy the sheet music for it and they'd bring it home. And the industry to publish this sheet music, that is the area, the place where the offices, where the composers would work and the publishing houses were in New York, at first sort of around 14th Street near where the theaters were, and then moving a little bit north towards the Midtown as the theater district shifted, is Tin Pan Alley. It's called Tin Pan Alley because a writer went to go do a series on the music publishing industry in New York, and on the first floor of most publishing houses, they would have these places where the writers would try and pitch the songs to potential customers or club owners. And often the pianos were pretty threadbare, a little bit out of tune. So he goes to try and conduct this interview, and he's hearing this cacophonous sound of out-of-tune pianos 20 of them trying to sort of pitch individual songs. And to him, it just sounded like somebody banging on a tin pan. And so he wrote a series called Tin Pan Alley, and thus the name.
Hence the name. Well, you have selected some music for us that is fundamental to the Great American Songbook, starting with a piece by Irving Berlin. Let's hear some of Blue Skies.
Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see. Blue birds singing a song, nothing but blue birds all day long. Never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by, when you're in love, my, how they fly. Blue days, all of them gone, nothing but blue skies from now on.
We are listening to the incomparable Ella Fitzgerald sing Blue Skies. I think I mentioned this to you last time, if not the time before, Adam. If one were to ask me for recommendation for recordings of various installments of those top six composers and the Great American Songbook, they would all be Ella, I mean, as first choices. And we heard her in a 1943 recording there, which sounded pretty good remastered.
We are in total agreement about Ella. So I wanted to share Blue Skies because there are a lot of ways that this song is indicative of the beginning part of the Great American Songbook. First of all, it has a 32-bar structure. It's got a lot of the songs in the Great American Songbook that came out of Tin Pan Alley, and then that style influenced the Broadway musicals of the day, follow a very specific and semi-rigid structure. Most of them are 32 bars. That's the number of measures in the song. And they typically have an A-A-B-A structure. So there's a verse, another verse that's very similar, and then a bridge that's musically a bit different, and then returning to the original verse pattern. So that Blue Skies follows that. Another thing that it is, it's a good example of, is that the music of that day when the Great American Songbook was born, often it showed up in a show, and often the way that it showed up had sort of nothing to do with the story of the show. This is a good example. There's a word that you see a lot when you look at this era called interpolation, which means they would just shove a song into the middle of a show if they thought it would work. So the lead of the show or the star might say, "Hey, I heard a song on the street today," and then it didn't have anything to do with the story,
but it sounded good.
Right. So the star of a 1924 show came to Irving Berlin and said, "Oh, please, I need I don't have anything good in this." It was a Rodgers and Hart musical called Betsy. And he said, "Well, I have something in my trunk. It might work for you." He went over to his house. He only had that A section. Pulled an all-nighter, figured out that B, that bridge, which is part of what makes the song so genius, and then they just shoved it into this show.
How did Rodgers and Hart feel about Irving Berlin interpolating into their musical?
I am not 100% sure, but I will guess that, one, you see a lot of people griping about this process, the songwriters. The producers loved it, and the stars loved it, because it might mean that the songs, and this is another theme of today, the songs were the star in a different era. And so when the songs are the star, it doesn't really matter if it comes out of the story. You went to see that show for that great song, and the star did it. The songwriters kind of typically hated it. That said, Irving Berlin was already the elder statesman, and these were the up-and-comers, so it might have been fun for each of them to kind of be at the same theater and collaborating a little.
A star turn, if you will.
Exactly. Oh, one other thing that I wanted to mention about Blue Skies. There is an 1890 book that detailed what you should do if you wanted to write a successful Tin Pan Alley song. And the writer said, you write sophisticated lyrics, only sophisticated people are going to buy it. But you write simple lyrics, everybody's going to buy it. And he actually said, you know, maximum 1 3-syllable word, maybe a few 2-syllable words. And if you look at Blue Skies, Irving Berlin certainly could write sophisticated lyrics, but typically they erred on the side of simplicity.
But not dumbing down, not condescending.
That's a great point, that part of the genius of these songwriters, especially the lyricists during this era, was a way to figure out how to condense language, to write simple words, but in a condensed poetic style that at first pass feels conversational. But in fact, if you look at how many images, how it relates to the situation, how it reveals character, is really quite dense. So there was kind of an attention to distilling things into a diamond level of simplicity.
The Gershwins are up next with a song written by George and his brother Ira's lyricist in 1930. This is I Got Rhythm.
Look at what I've got.
Oh, my Ethel Merman has had a lot of caffeine in that recording, and isn't she astonishing that?
This was the song and the musical that launched her in 1930. She was working as a sometime singer, but as a secretary in Astoria, Queens, and she got to audition for George Gershwin. He blew her out of the water of the water with the quality of her voice. And he said, are you studying with anybody? And she said, no. He said, don't ruin that voice. And then he asked her if he should change anything about the song. She said, no, I think it'll work just fine. One of the things I wanted to chat about with I Got Rhythm. Similarly, Ira, very keen attention to distilling language and making simple things that are also dense with thought. When he wrote the lyrics for this, he had George's melody, and he was playing around to sort of figure out what would work. And he often would start with a dummy lyric to kind of help him figure out what the rhythm of language should be. And for this one, his dummy lyric was, roly-poly, eating solely, ravioli, better watch your diet or bust. And so he kind of played around with that, and then he got to I Got Rhythm. So,
wait, Ira or George?
Ira wrote those dummy lyrics. He would hear the tune, and then he needed to sort of figure out what the rhythm of language should be before he then. So because a tune, you can accent any number of ways. You can set lyrics any number of ways. He had to sort of figure out where the accents would be and where in the melody he was going to put language. And then once he had that, he then wrote the actual lyrics. So
what an amazing glimpse into the process of lyricism.
Absolutely. And Ira actually wrote a book about his process that I highly recommend. And it's a great window into his mindset. Another reason why I think I Got Rhythm is worth thinking about as representative of the Great American Songbook is that George Gershwin, musical genius, could conquer multiple genres. He, even though the song sort of has this upbeat, peppy, deceptively simple vibe, there's complicated rhythmic changes in it. And as a result, lots of other musicians have really enjoyed riffing on it. And that's another thing that I think is important to understand about 50 years of writing great songs. And then there's another 20 or 30 years of interpreting them by both the vocal stylists like Sinatra and Ella, but also the jazz greats. And there are versions by Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie riffing on I Got Rhythm.
Of course. When it comes to the ultimate sophistication, smooth, urbane, it must be Cole Porter.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you neath the moon or under the sun. Whether near to me or far, no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day, day and night.
Oh, Frank Sinatra, I think, in top form, a 1962 recording of Cole Porter's Night and Day. Not how Porter conceived the song when he wrote it originally.
No, but again, I think indicative of the quality of songwriting of that moment, that they, again, the songs were the stars. They wrote them for an initial deployment. But I think most songwriters had the optimism that it would exist in many other variations, that it would get launched in a play, then it would get published, then a band leader might pick it up. And I think that's also a good way of thinking about Night and Day as indicative. It got launched in a musical called The Gay Divorce, and it was a Fred Astaire stage vehicle. And then Hollywood picked it up, and they cut most of the songs from the other stage musical, but kept that one, and the film got turned into The Gay Divorcee, because the idea that a divorce could be peppy or happy or was just, you know, verboten to the censors. But you could potentially have a happy divorcee. So anyway, the way in which this song was born, also, I think, a little bit indicative of Cole Porter. He has to write this Astaire tune, this song for Astaire. Astaire had a limited vocal range, and so he's got parameters. He can only write within about an octave, and that also is not atypical for how a lot of these songs were created. It wasn't that the songwriters of this era sat in a corner and just dreamed up things without parameters. We talked about the 32-bar structure. Often, again, going back to that 1890s book, there was the advice that if a family's sitting around the piano, there's probably not going to be more range than one octave, so you should sort of keep it limited. So a lot of the Tin Pan Alley folks wrote within these sort of limited ranges. And then finally, once you start dealing with stars, you're writing for their voice. So in many respects, the later life of a song finds its full potential because its initial deployment had these limitations on it.
Indeed, if you think of someone like Sarah Vaughan, you know, taking it all over into how many octaves, that illustrates it well. It illustrates it beautifully. A melancholy love ballad that has so far more than 600 recordings by various artists is My Funny Valentine. That was a Rodgers and Hart tune from 1937. Let's hear it.
You're my funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile with my heart. like you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak when you open it?
Could not pot that down any sooner. Fade that down. I'm showing my age in broadcasting. Couldn't fade that any sooner. We had to let Ella sing an entire verse. Okay, I wanted to be dancing cheek to cheek, different composer, with my husband. That's just so warm and romantic, and yet it's so sad.
One of the hallmarks of the American songbook or standards is that they've become things that people expect in clubs. So often, again, we've talked about this idea of a canon or a list. There's a bunch of songs that if you go to a certain kind of club, that it's going to have a jazz singer or a jazz quartet or even a big band, they're, most everybody, if not everybody, sort of needs to know a bunch of songs. My Funny Valentine is certainly one of those songs. It's something that absolutely all jazz musicians sort of just need to know. And again, I think one of the interesting things that is a returning theme for us as we talk about the Great American Songbook is the interplay of cultures that have gone into creating it. So a lot of the composers and lyricists of that era were Russian Jews who had just immigrated, and they were often living in close proximity to black neighborhoods and being heavily influenced by ragtime and jazz. Their songs showed that influence, and then in turn, African American jazz musicians were picking up these songs and then morphing them into this totally different and new form called jazz. And we can talk perhaps in another show about why jazz uses these in terms of its structure. But I will simply say on this one that My Funny Valentine has a simple and classical musical structure that makes it very easy to adapt for other genres and for jazz musicians to then morph it in the way that they want to.
And I think it is best experienced with your eyes closed. Mm. That is, listening to it. I guess if you were singing it or playing the music, your eyes should probably be open. What's extraordinary about Blues in the Night?
We've talked about So this is a song written by Harold Arlen as the composer and Johnny Mercer as the lyricist.
Good Georgian.
Yes, yes. We can go see his house in Savannah. we talked about that 32-bar structure. Not all songwriters always lived with inside the rules. So Arlen blew this wide open and wrote blues. He was riffing on the style of blues music. And again, we talk about that interplay that both Mercer and Arlen, growing up, lived very close to black neighborhoods, and their music is entirely influenced by the black sounds that they heard in their youth.
There were several performers, Ethel Waters among them, who thought Harold Arlen was black.
Yes, yes. Following the same pattern of why these songs are indicative of the Great American Songbook. It was written for a movie, a Hollywood musical in the 19... There was a huge Hollywood musical boom in the 30s and 40s. And that's important to understand that a lot of the songwriters moved from New York to write from writing Broadway tunes, and they moved to Hollywood. And it's very typical that their songs, the best ones, outlasted the movie. This one, pretty much as soon as they'd written it, they went over to a friend's house, you know, this kind of star-studded house. They showed up at a dinner party at 10 p.m., and they got a bunch of folks around the piano, and the party had Martha Raye and Judy Garland and Mel Torme, Mickey Rooney, and they sat around the piano. They played this song, and everybody knew that this was going to be kind of an earth-shaking hit.
Well, let's hear some of those blues in the night.
My mama done told me when I was in knee pants. My mama done told me, son.
What did she tell you?
A woman of sweet talk.
Yeah.
I'll give you the glare eye.
Uh-huh.
But when the sweet talk is done,
keep on a talking.
A woman's a two-face, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues. In the night.
Yes, in the night.
Now the rains are falling, hear the train are calling.
We got Cab Calloway there with Blues in the Night. Our final example that you have chosen, Adam, is a waltz. It almost seems simple. It's a waltz in a minor key that also provides seemingly endless opportunity for jazz riffs. What can you tell us about My Favorite Things?
Eventually, the industry started to shift a little bit. We had had this explosion of first music publishing, then radio shows up, and there's this ability to distribute in a slightly different way. Then movies are also popularizing songs. And the big hits of the first part of the 20th century largely came from New York, often started in theater, in some cases started in film, attached to shows, and the hit makers from this era were often these kind of songwriters. By the time My Favorite Things rolls around, rock and roll is on the ascent. The rise of the singer-songwriter is about to happen with the Beatles, and the music industry is just changing entirely. And so there were some kind of final throes of the creation of the American songbook as we know it. And we had talked before about Rodgers and Hammerstein as being this iconic duo of songwriters for the Broadway stage. They wrote A Sound of Music. It wasn't as huge of a hit on the stage as it was on the screen. And it was also, sadly, Oscar Hammerstein's last thing that he wrote before he passed away. And again, as you said, it's sort of deceptively simple. It works beautifully in the context of we had talked before about integrated book musicals. It works perfectly in the context of the show, where the lead character has to calm down a bunch of very scared children, and it shows both her character, how she's this kind of upbeat person. She can morph scary things into happy things by the power of her mind. She calms down all the kids, and it's absolutely lovely. Then, a couple of years later, again, we've talked about this, other composers or musicians taking things and then remixing them, you know, and becoming something totally different. And My Favorite Things is a foundational recording by Coltrane.
Well, we have it. Let's listen to that clip. the inimitable John Coltrane with My Favorite Things. You're one of my favorite guests, Adam.
It's so fun to be here, Lois.
It's so fun to have you, and so illuminating. Director Adam Copeland is the artistic director of Flying Carpet Theater. The Great American Songbook is one among many of his areas of expertise. Adam, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.